Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Tracy Holmes-Donowski for the appellant. This court should reverse the Administrative Review Board's decision affirming the ALJ's decision and order and enter judgment in favor of CP for three independent reasons. First, the board applied the wrong legal standard when it determined that Mr. Riley established contributory cause based solely on chain of events causation. Second, the ALJ's finding that CP acted in good faith at the time it investigated and suspended Riley with a time-served suspension, a finding unappealed and left intact by the board, precludes a finding that CP acted with intentional retaliation. And third, the board applied the wrong legal standard and made findings unsupported by substantial evidence when it determined that CP failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence that it would have taken the same action, notwithstanding his protected activity. Let me address each of those in turn, and I'd like to start with contributory factor. I'd first like to note that the board's legal assessments are reviewed de novo in this regard, and the court can affirm only where the board correctly applied the law, and the board and ALJ did not do so with respect to contributory factor.
The findings are reviewed for substantial evidence, right? Not clear error.
Clear error, correct. The legal findings are de novo.
No. When your third issue, you were talking.
Oh, yes.
I thought I heard you say it was clear error, but that's not the standard.
Correct. They're unsupported by substantial evidence factually on the third issue, but we also submit that there's a legal error there too. Your Honor, the ALJ in fact committed legal reversible error on contributory factor because he relied solely on chain of events causation in holding that Mr. Riley established contributory cause. The ARB confirmed this legal error when it also plainly disregarded this circuit's well-established legal precedent that to establish causation under FERSA, a plaintiff must prove intentional retaliation prompted by that employee's protected conduct.
Counsel, is this really a chain of events case? I know that the agency said it was, but I wonder whether this really is, in the sense that this is unlike our other cases in which the investigation led to some other finding about an employee that formed the basis for the discipline. Here, it was the late filing of the protected activity itself. So is this really a chain of events case?
I believe it is, Your Honor, and that's how it was presented, certainly by Mr. Riley throughout the case. He pursued and attacked and challenged his case solely on chain of events. It's also known as an inextricably intertwined type case, in contrast to the Kudyk case, let's say, where the protected activity is so far unrelated to the ultimate discipline. So I do think he not only is a chain of events, but the plaintiff here relied solely on that theory, which if you look at the Seventh Circuit's case in Koziara, the plaintiff is master of his case, and he lived and died by this chain of events argument, which we would submit because of that, he shouldn't be entitled to a do-over because the chain of events analysis here is clear error. This court has clearly and unequivocally held over and over again.
So this is not a case where the agency or the judge below pushed him to take a particular view, because if you see the opinions below, as you mentioned in your brief, they seem to want to ignore some of our case law, or at least amend it, I would say. And so this is a case where he pushed this chain of events theory.
Not only pushed it, but it solely relied on it.
Okay.
Yep. This court has squarely held, as I mentioned, chain of events causation is legally insufficient. We know that from the Blacker B1 case, the Heim case, the BNSF versus DOL case. In fact, in Blacker B1, in the first decision there, they expressly rejected adopting the Third Circuit more lenient standard in Oahu and expressly followed Kudyk, requiring intentional retaliation. In footnote 5 of this court's decision in the Luce case, Eighth Circuit reiterated, although plaintiff cites to Oahu, which employs a more lenient standard, we explained in Blackerby that the Eighth Circuit follows Kudyk, not Oahu. This case law leaves no question, Your Honors, no doubt that intentional retaliation is the legal standard in this circuit. Yet a review of the ALJ's decision and the ARB's affirmance are clear that the only findings made were chain of events to establish contributory cause. The ALJ's decision is unequivocal on this point. Page 14 of the ALJ's decision. Complainant need not demonstrate the existence of retaliatory motive. Neither motive nor animus is required to prove causation under FERSA. This is clear legal error under Kudyk and its consistent progeny. The ALJ further confirmed its legal reversible error by finding...
Well, the ARB's footnote 13 was even worse.
Correct, Your Honor. I was just going to
did
get
it have
there.
Six or seven reasons that Kudyk was wrong?
It absolutely did, Your Honor. Absolutely. I was going to go there very next. Footnote 13 is a directly in
they're,
conflict.
They're looking for first cert granted and destroy an unfavorable conflict in the circuits.
Perhaps that's
so
the case.
So we're just the middle station here.
Clearly, the footnote 13 is in direct conflict with Your Honor and this court, this circuit's well-established law. And none of the government's arguments, Your Honors, can save that reversible and dismissible error. Inextricably intertwined, the argument they make, that's been rejected by this circuit. That's just another form of chain of events, which has been clearly held insufficient. That doesn't carry the day. The government's attempt to claim that the ALJ relied on more than causation, in fact, is incorrect, and it asks this court to really rewrite the decision ex post facto, which the court should decline to do. The government's argument that the ALJ didn't rely on only chain of events, it isn't supported by the record. Pages 14 and 15 is solely causation and fact analysis. Other arguments the secretary seeks to rewrite into the ALJ decision ex post facto, which we urge this court to decline. Timing. The secretary claims that temporal proximity supports a finding of intentional retaliation. The government concedes, though, that the ALJ did not use temporal proximity in its contributory analysis. And it was error for the board to fill in those findings, as this court properly held in the BNL versus DOL case. Moreover, because the ALJ didn't...
Now, I understand why the CP, having fired Botman or whoever and decided and not to fire Riley, would then look for an alternative discipline. But why late report? And why 47 days without pay?
So
that strikes me as irrational and punitive.
It's the prompt reporting that he failed to. You know, the rules require that you promptly report both at your first means of communication and, you know, by the end of the shift.
Yeah,
and
but
so
the supervisor didn't even care.
Right. Well, which wasn't a finding made by the in terms of the manager, the testimony that's cited too. Yeah.
I mean, that's the evidence.
So the 47 days comes about because the court or when the carrier issued that ruling, keep in mind it was a time-served suspension. It could have been 35 days. It could have been 20 days. The ultimate discipline ended up being however long it took. They removed both of them from service. At the time, they reasonably had legitimate reasons to notice them for investigation. It just so happens that hearing and decision time took 47 days. That's how they came to the 47 days.
Didn't need to. And they didn't have to do that equation either. Whose testimony do I read to get the reasoning of the decision makers on this penalty?
The evidence in the record would show that Mr. Morris was the hearing officer. He wrote a recommendation and then forwarded that recommendation to Mr. Cork, his supervisor, Jennifer Manns, who served as the labor relations review, and Jerry Peck. Morris testifies to those would have been the three individuals who would have subsequently reviewed that. Now, Your Honor, what's in the record...
Any of those three testify?
They did not, Your Honor. So they were no longer employed at the company at the time. We have documentary evidence showing that Morris completed his recommendation. He actually recommended dismissal for both Bowman and Riley for all the violations alleged, including the altercation. But then subsequently, upon that multi-level review, it was determined that to exercise leniency as to Mr. Riley, it's undisputed that Mr. Riley stood for dismissal given his prior disciplinary record.
Let's suppose that we put aside this FRSA statute and we're just looking at Mr. Riley's situation, and he has been, there's certainly a good case that he's been excessively disciplined, at least from the standpoint of the duration of it. So what are his remedies?
The remedies aside from the first...
Other than to look away from the collective bargaining situation and seek some federal...
He has a direct remedy under the collective bargaining agreement, and he actually exercised it.
And
he received a reduction of the suspension to 15 days, but the court affirmed that the carrier was correct and substantial evidence supported the violation for prompt reporting of the injury. So they affirmed.
The 15 days was?
Reduced the 47 to 15, ultimately.
So he has received pay for the other 32 days?
He did, yes. And that's part of the record. And
and the board still imposed a 47-day remedy?
The board, the ALJ did award the 11,000, the full 47 days in back pay, you mean? Huh? Yeah, they did. And then subsequent to that, CP made a motion to correct and clarify that based on the carrier's decision that reduced it to a 15-day to avoid a windfall, because he had received, you know, 47 days of back pay as part of the damage award by the ALJ.
Okay, so but we're just looking at 15 days from
correct
from your standpoint.
Correct. Yes.
Thank Counsel, you were talking about the recommendation, how the recommendation made its way up the chain.
Correct.
But who was the ultimate decision maker?
Well, the record is, the best we have in the record of this is that it would be reviewed by the two managers, Mr. Cork, Mr. Peck, who was above Mr. Cork, and then labor relations with Jennifer Mance.
But we really don't know who the decision maker was, right?
Correct. We have these three individuals who reviewed it. But, I mean, from an authority standpoint, Mr. Peck was above Mr. Cork. But, yes, there's nothing beyond the recommendation and Mr. Morris's testimony.
So if that's the case, you mentioned at the very beginning what the what disposition you would ask us to make here. And I thought you said that it should go back and with a determination here, ultimate determination of the case in favor of the railroad.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. We think two levels, dismissal and at minimum a remand, given the improper legal standards.
What about if it went back with if it was vacated, went back with instructions to apply the correct standard? Is that another option, or why isn't that the appropriate?
That would be the alternative request. It's both. We think as a matter of law, dismissal can be made based on the briefing arguments we've raised, but we alternatively, at a minimum, certainly given the contributory factor legal errors on the reversible error, at minimum a remand is necessary because the ALJ did not conduct critical factual findings, weighing credibility, looked at the various factors that are required under the proper legal standard, and this court did so in the BNSF versus DOL case.
So if it went back with instructions to apply the correct standard, but we don't know who the decision maker is, where does that leave us?
Well, I think that the record is sufficient to still show that a multi-level review process was conducted, that these individuals reviewed it, and that they exercised leniency towards him. The plaintiff didn't call these individuals either, and I think more so on his part, because it's his burden to show intentional retaliation.
Why don't we know who the decision maker is? Is there some kind of obligation of the railroad to be forthcoming here and explain to the decision maker, the legal decision maker here, what happened here? Who made the ultimate decision?
Yes, I think you can glean it from the record, from Mr. Morris's testimony, that these were the three individuals who would have had to review it. And given Mr. Cork, Mr. Peck, or Mr. Peck would have, I mean, knowing their managerial titles, he would have been above Cork. Mr. Peck would have been last to review. And what's important here, too, is Ms. Mance provided the labor relations review, which certainly gives an independent review aside from managerial review.
How do we dismiss it, though? And I want to get back to Judge Loken's question. If this is arguably punitive because of the protected conduct, or at least we can say 47 days is arguably excessive, how can we say, as a matter of law, that the railroad would have made the same decision in the absence of protected conduct?
I would love to get to affirmative defense, so thank you so much for going there, Your Honor, because I have two very critical points to make on affirmative defense, and they are this. Bowman is your operative comparator in this case, Your Honors. He is a union employee like Mr. Riley. Both engineers governed by the same CBA, both involved in the same incident, same day, same shift. Both were noticed for hearing under the collective bargaining agreements for the exact same alleged rule violations. And where the ALJ departed in error was the ALJ looked at the two letters, the suspension letters, Mr. Riley's suspension letter and Mr. Bowman's dismissal letter. Mr. Riley had a statement about the fact it was found that he did not promptly report his injury. Mr. Bowman did not. But Mr. Bowman's dismissal letter had multiple rule violations that the carrier determined he had violated. Two of those rule violations are the prompt reporting rules.
But even so, that gets back to my question. If we view it as excessive, it just seems to me to be very hard for us to then come in and say, let's decide this as a matter of law.
I think in terms of the excessiveness, I think that's a determination where you're getting back at. I would fear that as a court, the court has often stated it's not your role to act as a super personnel department and re-examine those decisions. And I think that given that the carrier, and this ALJ found that the CP acted in good faith when it disciplined him for the 47 days. He actually made a finding of good faith. And so I think to re-examine the 47 days is getting back into acting like a super personnel.
Could I ask one more question, which is, don't we have a problem, too, in deciding this as a matter of law? So if you look at the BNSF case, that was a summary judgment motion. The district court, we were looking at a district court record, as I recall. Here, we've got an agency record. So shouldn't we send it back to the agency for a determination in the first instance? In other words...
At a minimum, Your Honor. Yeah. Okay. At a minimum, correct. And, but on the affirmative defense...
Might have been Kudyk I was talking about, but
yeah,
but
no,
one
you're
of the
correct.
Two.
That's correct. Yeah. But if I just might finish about the Bowman issue, Bowman was disciplined for and dismissed, and he had no protected activity. He had less discipline. I think that the record under the court's indicia that looks at under Kudyk for affirmative defense, when you put Bowman and you correct the error that this ALJ made, he was disciplined for the late report as well. And then the managers, Your Honor, were not proper comparators on the affirmative defense. They're different roles. But Mr. Morris... The testimony was elicited from Mr. Morris. He's a hearing officer. He had no supervisory disciplinary authority over these managers. He doesn't even work at the same location. And so he didn't have any personal knowledge as to whether they violated anything or were disciplined or not. He testified, I'm not aware. None as to what I'm aware. So that whole testimony was elicited in a very hypothetical, lots of assumptions that we don't think are supported by the record. So Bowman is your comparator when you correct that error. I'm sorry I exceeded my time. I'll reserve any balance if there's any at the end. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. McDonald.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mary McDonald, and I represent the Secretary of Labor. Mark Riley was assaulted by a coworker while on duty, and later that same day reported both the incident and his resulting injury.
Let me ask you a question before you, we know all the facts for one thing, you may want to think about this. Would your client prefer to have us follow our law and reverse so that it's timely to bring a cert petition claiming a conflict in the circuits and we're all wrong? Or would your client prefer to have it sent back with instructions to apply our law to this record? Which I think their answer would, I know what answer they'd want to give. Question would be, could they possibly shape it to do that? But why would they want that? ARB or the Secretary of Labor?
Your Honor, the ARB, I believe in footnote 13, was seeking clarification of this court standard.
Oh, they didn't need it. That's I'm sorry, but that doesn't pass the chuckle test.
Well, they certainly...
That footnote is crystal clear that we were wrong. And we've told you before we were wrong, and we're going to tell you again you were wrong. From Kudyk to all the cases following Kudyk.
It certainly questioned this court's holding.
So why wouldn't your client want to just have us say, no, you didn't follow the law here and go take it up?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the ARB noted an important point, which is that the terms intentional retaliation and retaliatory motive are often used interchangeably, but sometimes they seem to mean different things. And railroads, in my office's experience, railroads across the country have seized upon those terms to create a standard that is virtually impossible for whistleblowers in the railroad industry to meet. And that's essentially to require a whistleblower to have smoking gun direct evidence of the railroad's hostility or animosity. In footnote 13, I believe that the ARB was pointing out that such an interpretation is contrary to Congress's intent in creating the contributing
just
factors.
Practical realities, though. We had two union members get in, not a fist fight, but a physical altercation while driving a huge train. Now, the railroad has every interest in having that reported. So the notion that a railroad would retaliate against people for reporting an unsafe situation in which it's union members fighting with each other when the reason they don't report is to cover up for each other because they know the discipline that's coming. This notion that this was a safety retaliation for late reporting is just so counterintuitive, I consider it absurd. The railroad would want that to be reported, and they'd want to know right away because their equipment was being used in a way that created a hazard for countless persons and property.
I certainly agree, Your Honor, and the lower courts
here. How can this be illegal retaliation when it's so counterintuitive, though? It's not just that the chain of events inextricably intertwined is mumbo-jumbo. It's that it's, in this situation, totally counterintuitive.
Well, I agree that workplace violence creates a hazardous safety or security condition, which is why reporting it is protected activity under the FRISA. However, here, Mr. Riley was not actually found guilty of any rule violation relating to the physical altercation. Mike Morris, the hearing officer, the only rule violation for which he was found responsible was late reporting.
How many fellow workers urged him to report this when they heard about it?
Several,
right?
And he did in fact report it.
But he didn't want to because he didn't want the other guy to get in trouble or himself. See, he wanted to conceal from the railroad a serious safety problem, and now the railroad is being punished for anti-safety retaliation.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the railroad isn't...
Why can't we apply a little common sense here?
Well, the railroad isn't being punished. No punitive damages were assessed. Mr. Riley has simply...
I didn't mean it in the punitive damages sense. They're being punished. They're being spanked for violating a safety law.
Your Honor...
By the U.S. Department of Labor.
Well, we believe that this is a case in which protected activity did contribute to the adverse action. And I would note, while certainly the railroad has the right to enforce legitimate safety rules, Congress made it very clear that they...
Okay, inextricably intertwined. Let's suppose that when he was finally persuaded to report, Riley had filed a false report as to what happened. And he was then disciplined, either for lateness or falseness or both, and he brings this action. Well, the punishment was inextricably intertwined, wasn't it? If he hadn't filed a false report, there wouldn't have been discipline. Isn't this taking the but-for causation notions to a ridiculous extreme?
Well, the department wouldn't find contributing factor in that case. That would be similar to the Seventh Circuit's decision in Armstrong.
They would have to then explain why the inextricably intertwined theory, which they thought makes this an open and shut case, doesn't apply.
Well, as a threshold matter, there would be no protected activity in that case. Complainants have to have a good faith belief.
Oh, he filed a report.
But it wasn't done in good faith. So under, for example, the Seventh Circuit's Armstrong decision, that wouldn't qualify as protected activity. But moreover, that would be a case that's more similar, I would argue at least, to BNSF, for example, where you have an independent intervening reason why the railroad took the activity. And in that case, it would be the dishonesty or the false report itself.
There's nothing intervening. The report is the but-for reason for the ultimate discipline.
But it wouldn't be the proximate cause in that case. It wouldn't be the legally significant reason. The legally significant reason that presumably would wipe out the contributing factor showing.
I'm sorry. What's the difference between false and late?
Well, false would imply that the complainant did not have a good faith belief and, once again, did not actually engage.
The falsity might have been completely different. It might have been this was a serious safety problem, but it wasn't my fault, or it was a third employee's fault. And the railroad investigates and found that, yeah, you made a safety report you had to make, but it was completely wrong. So we're gonna discipline you.
Well, I think in those circumstances,
how is that different from saying, yeah, you made a safety report, but it was way too late, so we're gonna discipline you?
I believe that the board would find in that case that the falsity of the report would likely overcome the showing of contributing factor causation.
Okay, give me a board site to support that.
I don't have a board site on point for that.
And we're just speculating.
We would speculate. But I think even under the analysis set forth in this case, in that kind of circumstance, it would be highly likely that the railroad would prevail at the affirmative defense stage. Even if in that case the complainant satisfied the contributing factor test,
which seems unlikely. That you're right and that there's a more direct causal link here because of the filing of the report and the lateness of the report kind of go together. The problem I'm still having with your argument is the face of the ARB order, which essentially says we're going to apply a chain of events theory. They said it, the ALJ said it, and that's not the law in this circuit. And so don't we just have to send this back? And sure, the ALJ and the ARB can say the same thing you're saying on remand, but don't we at least have to send it back so that they apply the right law?
We think there are sufficient factual findings that were made in this case that would support affirmance of the ALJ and ARB decisions. The ALJ and ARB did not solely rely on chain of events causation. There was cabining language where the ALJ and ARB acknowledged that chain of events alone may be sufficient, but it doesn't automatically per se establish causation. And they found other facts that are highly relevant.
And you don't think that particular thing that you just said, that it's relevant, is a problem in light of our case law? In other words, how do we know that didn't sort of affect the rest of the analysis of the ARB, thinking, well, chain of causation or chain of events is good enough, and therefore we don't have to make the findings we would normally make?
Well, this court has said that chain of events and inextricably intertwined analysis is not alone sufficient to satisfy contributing factor, not that it's irrelevant. So I think the fact that the ALJ and ARB found those things, in addition to other facts that are equally important, can satisfy the contributing factor test. For example, here it's relevant that both the railroad had knowledge of the protected activity and chose to discipline Riley solely for the late reporting violation, despite Mike Morris's recommendation that other rule violations be assessed. There's also strong temporal proximity. Mr. Riley was pulled out of service less than 24 hours after he engaged in protected activity. The ALJ and ARB also expressed skepticism regarding the reasonableness of the railroad's determination that the report itself was untimely. They found that Mr. Riley had made efforts to make the report as soon as he felt physically safe to do so.
You rely on the temporal proximity, but the temporal proximity also works against the argument in the sense that they needed to investigate. Now, maybe 47 days was too long to investigate, but when you have a serious safety issue on the railroad, they need to figure out who's at fault and whether it's safe to put either one of these back on the railroad immediately. So doesn't that cut against the argument you're making?
It's certainly true that the suspension, while an adverse action, isn't the relevant adverse action here. The relevant adverse action is the discipline. We don't disagree that there were reasons why the railroad needed to investigate the incident based on the evidence that it had. But even the 47-day span that elapsed is temporally proximate, particularly in light of the fact that there were no independent intervening events that occurred. The railroad hasn't proffered or put forward any other reasons why Mr. Riley was disciplined in this case.
Well, I was just going, you seem to place a lot of emphasis on the 24 hours, and the 24 hours doesn't seem real relevant to me, given that they needed to investigate the incident.
We agree, and we don't disagree that they needed to investigate. Other facts in the record, though, that do support the finding of contributing factor here include the fact that the Canadian Pacific's reporting policy was inconsistently applied, and the railroad hasn't presented any evidence that it regularly monitored for compliance with its prompt reporting rules, or that a 47-day suspension would be reasonable or routine or a customary punishment for this kind of violation. And in fact, Labor Relations Manager Scoots actually testified that he wasn't aware of any other employee who had ever been assessed comparable discipline for a similar violation. All of these facts are relevant and support the ALJ and ARB's findings of contributing factor causation. Moreover, substantial evidence supports their conclusions that the Canadian Pacific did not show that it would have taken the adverse action absent the protected report in this case. We believe that Canadian Pacific's inability or unwillingness to identify the final decision maker in this case presents a significant hurdle to their ability to satisfy the affirmative defense. With that, I'd like to yield the remaining 3 minutes of my time to the intervener's counsel.
Why couldn't discovery have probed that?
I believe the railroad did not produce. There is no evidence in the record as to the decision maker's identity, which presumably one would think the railroad would have in its records, but perhaps did not.
Well, I don't know who the adversary was in the hearing process, whether it was Labor Department or Mr. Riley's attorneys. But wasn't there the ability to find out? Send them an interrogatory, do a 30B6 deposition.
And that would have been Mr. Riley's attorney. All I know is that in the record, as counsel for the railroad admitted, there is just no evidence whatsoever about who made the final decision here. We only know two things about the final decision maker. The first is that they disregarded the recommendations of Mike Morris, and two, that in their letter they state that they reviewed the investigatory hearing transcript, which is
his recommendation to fire him.
Correct. And the transcript that was reviewed is full of references to protected activity. So all we really know about the decision maker is that they knew that protected activity existed and that that was something that influenced the final decision. And unless this court has more questions for me, I'd like to yield some time to the intervener's counsel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Corey Kronzer. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Riley. And Your Honors, I would just like to say that this is arguably one of the most important FERSA cases that has been
before
the court.
What's your client's stake in the game besides 15 days pay?
Your Honor, his stake in the game is that if this court finds that what the railroad did was okay, all the railroad employees under this court's umbrella are in danger of being terminated because solely of engaging in protected activity. What the railroad is asking this court to do is allow them to...
I don't understand. Is Mr. Riley a union officer or what?
He's not an officer. Well, he's a member.
He's a great American, and he wants to help the world.
Oh,
I don't. That's not a litigation stake in the game. It sounds to me like it's 15 days pay.
Well, Your Honor, I will say he was held out 47 days for the timeliness. In essence, he was fined $11,000.
Wait a minute. You're saying now that the 47 days was a violation of the act? Time it took to investigate?
Your Honor, the thing is
may have been unreasonable, but that was time investigation.
Well, Your Honor, the law explicitly says that. Well, you're right, Your Honor. The 47 days, but then the decision to not give him his back pay in full. The back pay he got from the Public Law Board was a year later, and it was not even the full. And also, the law is clear.
Wait a minute. What back pay was there besides the 47 days? I'm trying to probe.
He was held out of service for 47 days, and then they said, "Hey, we decided that you didn't report on time, so we're gonna say, hey, time served."
But okay, 15 days with interest. I'm still missing something.
Your Honor, the Public Law Board, which the railroad mentioned, is a different avenue. It's a union appeal. It's different than
I've been through that. Yeah.
And it came a year later. And it was based off of, they said 15 days was okay, and they said you can award him the remainder of his back pay in that case. So the Public Law Board said, okay, 15 days, fine, to investigate.
Hearing dollars and cents, what's he out other than 15 days pay plus interest?
$11,000 minus the Public Law Board's award of $6,000 and so. So he's out about $4,000. And Your Honors, but what's so important here is that the law is clear. And the law was enacted because Congress looked at how the railroad treated its workers and said, hey, the business decisions, it's not there. You cannot punish an employee for engaging in protected activity. There's not a time requirement. And what the railroad is asking this court to do is allow them to pass their own rules. This is the railroad's rules, saying you have to follow our requirements to engage in protected activity. If you don't, well, fine, you engage protected activity, but we're going to discipline you for breaking our own rules. They are not required to have this rule. This is their rule that they're upset about.
What's wrong with that, though? I mean, suppose that they had a rule that was more lenient and said you have to, you know, do it within 7 days, report an altercation. I mean, you know, that's a reasonable rule. They can set up rules so that they can promptly investigate and take care of any problems that are happening safety-wise.
No, I would agree, Your Honor. But the fact is that this is not a case like the Department of Labor where they investigate an altercation. If his notice letter had said, we're looking into your involvement in the altercation, that would be one thing. But his notice letter said, we're looking into two things, your involvement in the altercation and your failure to promptly report when you told us the same day that it happened. From the very outset, the railroad was looking into his timeliness of his report and then ultimately said, hey, we don't think you...
Same day or next day?
July 5th at 2 a.m. is when the altercation happened, and okay. He told his manager
2 a.m. to what, noon or 2 p.m.?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, Your Honor, it was roughly a 10-hour gap, and Mr. Riley was on shift for 11 hours. So if the incident happened at the beginning of shift and he reported at the end of the shift, well, that would have been a greater amount of time. But the railroad doesn't, there's not even a discipline policy in the record. There's nothing that the railroad can point to that says this is okay. There is nothing. There's the decision makers. There's no identity of them. There's no discipline policy in the record. Their alleged rule violation says immediately, but then they sit there and say promptly. It's a subjective interpretation.
Yeah, that's all collective bargaining. Grievance arguments.
I would respectfully disagree with a little bit of the rule implementation.
I know how it's gotten twisted around to being stuffed into a safety pigeonhole.
Your Honor, the rule that they cite to is under the G Corps, the General Code of Operating Rules, which is a set of rules and adopted by not all the railroads in the United States, but a fair amount of them. Then the railroads enact their own discipline policy, a lot of them incorporating those rules. The G Corps is not a discipline policy. There is no discipline policy in this record to support any, arguably to support any discipline whatsoever. The last chance agreement says, please see our discipline policy.
But that's not an FRSA argument. It's not even an FRSA issue.
It goes to
It's an issue that he took his remedy, he invoked his collective bargaining rights and rights, employee rights, and got relief.
Well, Your Honor, the statute does say you can't waive your FRSA rights, so the railroad worker can arguably...
Your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Dineski, use her time?
She did.
I'll give you a couple minutes for a bottle.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
I just was going to make one point, which is just that this record, to the government's argument that the record has sufficient findings in the record to affirm, it simply does not. We briefed that issue exhaustively in our reply brief as to the reasons why. And just by virtue of example, the temporal proximity argument, the ARB and the ALJ, it's the ARB who relied on, tried to fill in that finding in its board decision. The ALJ made no discussion, no findings about temporal proximity. But the reason even that alone isn't sufficient to affirm is this court has repeatedly held timing alone, even on an intertwined case, isn't enough standing alone. And in this case, this court has also said that temporal proximity, the probative value, is decreased significantly when, as here, the plaintiff has prior discipline in their record. This Mr. Riley stood for dismissal at the time he was reinstated to the company. He stood on the last chance agreement. He was already at the dismissal stage. And as to the fact the decision maker didn't follow the recommendation, he didn't follow it in Mr. Riley's favor. How can that be evidence of intentional retaliation? The findings aren't sufficient to affirm, as the government argues, and I'll rest on that point. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.